Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. For more than 40 years, Sally Mann, born in 1951 in Lexington, Virginia, has made experimental, elegiac, and hauntingly beautiful photographs, a broad body of work that includes figure studies, still lifes, and landscapes. Offering both a sweeping overview of Mann's artistic achievement and a focused exploration of the continuing influence of the South on her work, the exhibition Sally Mann, 1,000 Crossings, presents some 115 photographs, many of which have not been exhibited or published previously. This powerful and provocative work is organized into five sections: Family, The Land, Last Measure, Abide With Me, and What Remains. On view from March 4th through May 28th, 2018, the exhibition is accompanied by a fully illustrated catalog with essays that explore the development of Mann's art, her family photographs, the landscape as a repository of personal, cultural, and racial memory, and her debt to 19th century photographers and techniques. Sarah Greeno celebrates the exhibition with this introductory lecture recorded on opening day.
The seeds of this exhibition were planted in 2014 when we undertook a review of the photographs from the Corcoran Gallery of Art after its collection was placed under the stewardship of the National Gallery. Among the works, the Corcoran works that would greatly expand the depth and breadth of the National Gallery's collection were 25 photographs by Sally Mann made from the mid-1970s to the early 2000s. With this acquisition, coupled with pieces in the galleries, already in the gallery's collection or promised to us, the National Gallery became one of the largest repositories of Mann's photographs in the country. Mann is, of course, an exceptionally well-known artist, most celebrated at first for her 1992 publication, Immediate Family, and more recently for her 2015 award-winning memoir, Hold Still. Yet, as Sarah Kemmel and I looked through this material, we realized that despite this fame and prominence, the full range of her work had not received what we felt was sufficient scholarly and critical attention. Two important exhibitions, the Corcoran's 2004 exhibition, What Remains, The Life and Work of Sally Mann, and the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts 2010 exhibition, Sally Mann, The Flesh and the Spirit, had offered significant presentations of her work, but only one was accompanied by a catalog, the Virginia Museum Show, and only the Corcoran exhibition traveled, and that just to one venue. Our project, Sally Mann, 1,000 Crossings, seeks to address that lacuna with the first major traveling exhibition of her art, which will be presented at four other venues in this country and one in Europe. And the first thorough scholarly assessment of the development of scope of her art published in the accompanying exhibition catalog with essays by me, Sarah Kennell, Malcolm Daniel, who's the curator of photographs at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston, Hilton Alls, the New Yorker critic, and Drew Gilpin Faust, the president of Harvard but and also a noted Civil War historian. Although Sally Mann, 1,000 Crossings presents a broad sweep of her photographs from the 1980s to the present, it is not intended as a retrospective. Instead, it strives to make clear the profound importance that the South, as a place with a rich artistic tradition and a troubled history, has had in shaping Mann's art. A native of Lexington, Virginia, Mann has long written about what it means to live in the South and be identified as a Southern artist. Using her deep love of her native land and her knowledge of its fraught history, she asks provocative questions about history, identity, race, and religion that reverberate across geographic and national boundaries. Sally Mann, A Thousand Crossings seeks to explore how her relationship with this land has shaped her work and how the legacy of the South as both homeland and graveyard, refuge and battlefield continues to permeate the American experience. Mann herself has frequently identified the themes of the Southern artist, family, place, history, and race, and the organization of our exhibition follows her lead with five sections that investigate these subjects, titled Family, the Land, Last Measure, Abide with Me, and What Remains. Mann began to photograph in 1969, but got a degree, first a BA and then an MA from Hollins University in literature and creative writing. As we'll see, though, a love of literature, coupled with her deep belief in the power of fiction to speak to the human condition, propels much of her art. Our exhibition opens with a presentation of the family pictures Mann created between 1985 and 1994 that are the source of her early fame. Here we juxtapose well-known photographs with lesser-known and unpublished ones from this period to stress the generative function of place in their creation and offer, we hope, a more nuanced view of this project. Mann herself stressed the importance of the place in the introduction to her book, Immediate Family. The place is important, she wrote. The time is summer. It is any summer, but the place is home, and the people here are my family. In these pictures, she tells the story of the Edenic life the family enjoyed at their remote summer cabin in the Shenandoah Valley, nestled on a horseshoe bend on the Maori River. The long days and nights spent swimming, playing, and being together with no electricity or running water and far from the intrusions of late 20th century life. The poignant, highly innovative, and influential photographs she made during this time of her three children, Emmett, Jesse, and Virginia, record not only their daily activities and mishaps, but also the psychic complexity of childhood. Abandoning the treacly stereotypes of childhood that had characterized most fine art photographs of children before her, Mann instead shows beauty, sensuality, and tenderness, as well as anger, shame, confusion, distress, and the perennial struggle between attachment and independence. Mann quietly observed her children at rest and at play, transforming the intimate and the everyday into extraordinary moments. Jesse on the cusp of a dive, or Larry and a child napping. Yet most, not all, but most of the pictures were made with a large 8x10-inch view camera, usually mounted on a tripod, not here, handheld, as Sally seems to be trying to do in that picture there. And most of the photographs are the fruit of careful planning and tightly controlled execution. Mann was part of a generation of photographers who came to maturity in the 1970s and 80s and explored a more directorial and fictional approach to the medium. And Mann in these early pictures skirted the border between fact and fiction, the real and the imagined. Despite its spontaneous look, for example, Easter Dress was rehearsed and shot multiple times until Mann achieved the desired tension between the peripheral figures who all face in different directions and Jesse, who looks directly at the camera and displays the white Easter dress originally worn by Mann herself and made by Jesse's great-grandmother and namesake. Or look more closely at Jesse Bites. It too seems to document the raw aftermath of a clash between a defiant Jesse, who's adorned with war paint, and an unseen adult whose arm bears fresh teeth marks. But Mann made the marks on her own arm, and she and Jesse expertly recreated her sullen expression for the camera. Through this artifice, the picture convincingly expresses the fundamental childhood struggle between the need for independence and the desire for connection. As she sought to infuse this universal into the specific, Mann conceived of some of the photographs, but others were suggested by the children themselves. As she explained, "Sometimes I have an idea, usually based on something I've seen them do. When it's convenient, I'll arrange the scene and the kids work back into it. The final image, more often than not, is significantly affected by the children's interpretations or contributions. Some are gifts to me from my children, gifts that come in a moment as fleeting as the touch of an angel's wing." The angels did grace many of these pictures, for they are as sure and telling, as layered and nuanced as the greatest pictures of domestic life, revealing man's extraordinary ability to infuse the everyday with mythic significance. The ditch, for example, shows Emmett, his arms and legs bent under his body, tightly wedged in a muddy channel in between a glowing body of water in the foreground and the darker river behind. Although the allusions to birth, the river of life, and the passage from an ethereal inner world to a mysterious outer one are obvious, Mann transformed the scene into a dreamlike world through her innovative use of focus. Vignetting the picture around the edge, she created a swirling whirlpool that distorts, blurs, and darkens the people standing on the periphery, transforming them into eerie apparitions, witnessing Emmett's fraught rite of passage. The centrifugal pull of the composition sucks the viewer into the maelstrom, where the eye finally rests on Emmett's face, the only thing in sharp focus. The story Mann's pictures tell is one about the grand themes of family life, often told from a child's point of view, such as the pure, ecstatic delight siblings have in mastering a balancing act in the warm summer sunlight. But her pictures also show, also express those emotions that reside more exclusively with parents, showing a parenthood to be a delicate balancing act between profound love and gut-wrenching fear. The alligator's approach, and note the alligator there in the background, the alligator's approach speaks of every parent's dread of imminent unforeseen danger and the need to be constantly vigilant, even in paradise. Bloody Nose alludes to concerns about injury and the almost instinctive desire to protect a child from pain and suffering, while Emmett Floating broaches the unspeakable horror of the death of a child. The very strength and emotional honesty of these photographs and the conflicted feelings and responses they provoke in viewers, from aching love, fear, and protectiveness to the beguiling, even alluring nature of the children themselves, shake many viewers to the core, just as they did Mann herself. "The more I look at the life of the children," she wrote, "the more enigmatic and fraught with danger and loss their lives become." Yet it is, without question, Mann's inclusion of nude photographs of her children that elicited the most discussion. She was hardly the first fine art photographer to do so. From Julia Margaret Cameron, Gertrude Kasebier, Edward Weston, Emmett Gowan, one could go on. There is a rich tradition of photographers depicting nude children and, more broadly, the subject of childhood. Yet few photographers before or since Mann have made such a nuanced and multifaceted picture of childhood, one that addresses it from both the child and the adult's point of view. few have so successfully transformed their pictures into visual metaphors that address life's grand themes, and few have released their pictures at a worse time. In 1992, the year that Mann published many of these photographs in Immediate Family, the conservative commentator Patrick Buchanan popularized the term the culture wars, declaring that they were a battle for the soul of America. In the wake of the profound and tumultuous changes in American society that had occurred since the 1960s, the culture wars were a battle about abortion, affirmative rights, creationism, evolutionism, feminism, homosexuality, and school prayer. But the arts and the question of censorship, pornography, and government support were front and center. In 1989, conservatives such as Senator Jesse Helms were enraged when Andres Serrano's photograph of a crucifix suspended in urine, titled Piss Christ, was exhibited at an institution that had awarded Serrano a grant with funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. And of course, that same year, the Corcoran ignited a firestorm when it canceled an exhibition of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs that some thought contained pornographic images. While Immediate Family was swept up into this maelstrom, its reception was also clouded by several highly publicized cases of child sexual abuse, including the McMartin preschool trial in Manhattan, California. The rising number of cases of child abuse may be seen as symptomatic of the anxieties provoked by the changing role of women, their growing presence in the workplace, and the need for better child care. Many in the art world immediately came to Mann's defense, praising the beauty and originality of the photographs, as did the children themselves, who steadfastly supported the pictures then and now. But the inclusion of nude photographs of children and the exploration of childhood's complexity raised challenging questions concerning parental authority and artistic freedom. In the years since, as the panic over the depiction of nude children has subsided, Immediate Family has come to be seen as one of the most consistently affecting, revelatory, and transcendent depictions of childhood ever produced. Yet the book has not completely shed the mantle of controversy, as the questions it raises about privacy and exploitation and the distinction between public and private images have taken on new significance as the unregulated traffic in images is far more extensive than anyone could possibly have imagined 25 years ago. In the early 1990s, as critics both praised and condemned Immediate Family, Mann herself slowly found herself moving away from photographing her children and was increasingly drawn to the landscape behind them. She told a friend at the time, "The kids seem to be disappearing from the image, receding into the landscape. As I thought about making a picture with a child in it, I came to be seduced by the landscape, first of all, and then I would find a way to place the subject in it rather than the other way around. In a certain way, I was ambushed by the landscapes. They overwhelmed and commandeered my family picture aesthetic." She began by photographing the rolling hills, rivers, and forest near her home in Lexington in pictures that exude a deep sense of familiarity, the result of years of looking and thinking. Using the soft vignetting of her lens, she created the impression in Blue Hills, for example, that she was standing on the rise, hand cupped against her forehead, surveying the vista unfurling before her eyes. Often she photographed in the early morning or late afternoon when the landscape was dripping with humidity, infusing her languid, luminous pictures with a sense of profound mystery and longing. At this time, she renewed her friendship with the painter, sculptor, and also photographer, Cy Twombly, another native of Lexington, who returned there for several months each year. inspired by his softly focused photographs of inconsequential things, flowers, the corner of a studio, light coming in a window, Mann too began to search for scenes that were uncompelling. She discovered that views such as this one could be surprisingly seductive and noted, "These are the places and things most of us drive by unseeing. Scenes of southern dejection we'd contemplate only if our car broke down and left us by the verdant roadside." Seeking to capture what she called the radical light of the American South, she also looked back to the work of the 19th century Lexington, Virginia photographer Michael Miley, whose pictures of the Virginia countryside revealed to her new ways to articulate light, form, and space, and showed her the potential of a less than perfect negative. Although her earlier family pictures had required a technique, as she wonderfully said, so precise as to out-Ansel the most meticulous Adams, she now experimented boldly, using her 8x10-inch view camera with faulty antique lenses and high-contrast ortho film. Because ortho film can be developed while illuminated with a safe light, she was able to see the negative as it was emerging in the developing solution, allowing her to either over or underdevelop it to create unusual visual effects. And she even occasionally dribbled chemicals onto the negative to intensify the sense, as here, that it's a scene that's just materializing, emerging before our eyes. Her love of 19th century photography became ever more evident in the 1990s. Although this photograph was named after a state park on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain north of New Orleans, not the forest in France where the 19th century French photographer Gustave Le Gray made many of his most famous pictures, Mann, like her predecessor, used the dense overhanging boughs, their branches thickly entwined with kudzu and other vines, to weave the picture together. And like Le Gray, she lured viewers from that tangled canopy in the brightly tangled canopy in the foreground to the brightly lit field in the background, enticing them, as it were, from darkness to light, complexity to simplicity. Scarred Tree is another photograph that pays homage to Le Gray. Like Le Gray, she made no attempt to picture the tree in its entirety. Instead, by focusing on the gash across its trunk, a wound that had healed but still remained visible, she portrayed it as a silent witness to another age, revealing the landscape as a vessel for memory. Later in the 1990s, when Mann ventured further south to Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi, her photographs begin to allude to a larger national history of war, death, suffering, and injustice. As she absorbed the region's poverty and inequality, as well as the sense of oppression, pain, loss, decay, and even death that she said seemed to permeate the very air, she realized, as she wrote, that she had plunged into the heart of the country. But it's such a flawed heart. For me, the Deep South was haunted by the souls of millions of African Americans who built that part of the country with their hands and with the sweat and blood of their backs. Seeking to further explore the idea that the land could be a container for memory, she sought, as she wrote, to get the earth to give up the ghosts. She lingered near Money, Mississippi, the town where 14-year-old Emmett Till, an African-American from Chicago, was kidnapped and murdered in 1955 after allegedly flirting with a white woman. Like so many others, Mann had been haunted by the accounts of his death since her own childhood and had named her firstborn child Emmett. Marrying her horror with the larger national one, she retraced Till's route on the evening of his death, creating several photographs in homage to the young man. One, Bridge on the Tallahatchie, depicts the Black Bayou Bridge in Glendora, Mississippi, the place where many believe Till's naked, mutilated body was thrown into the river with a heavy fan from a cotton gin lashed around his waist. Showing a picturesque bridge nestled in the background and spanning a placid river, it is the kind of scene, in part, that might adorn the walls of the local chamber of commerce. Yet in the foreground, a skeletal branch reaches in from the left, like the scrawny fingered hand of death, and just below it, a seemingly careless chemical drip evokes a teardrop moving through the emulsion. At once ordinary but charged, beautiful but horrific, the image embodies the very paradox of the South itself. Guided by a friend, man then trekked through the dense underbrush to the site where they believed Till's body was pulled from the Tallahatchie River. When she got there, she wrote that she was disappointed by the humdrum backwashy scene before me. How could a place so weighted with historical pain appear so ordinary? Positioning her camera almost directly in front of the opening in the bush, she focused on a gash in the earth, an open wound-like form, to depict the place as barren and devoid of humanity in 1998 as it had been in 1955. But she also shot into the sun, allowing it to flood the heinous scene with light, in knowing defiance of Kodak's rule, and perhaps also mindful of Martin Luther King's admonition, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." She made one more photograph near Money, Mississippi. Concrete grave depicts an above-ground tomb in which concrete was poured directly over the deceased body, a common practice, man was told, a common practice in the area, she was told. Man herself has described the picture as emblematic of the plucky, undiminished South, a no-frills monument to the intractability of the overworked soil and the practical, impoverished, generous people who have long tried to wring a living from it. Yet as it was made so close to the site of Emmett Till's murder, this sealed, unmarked grave both recalls and contrasts with Till's own open coffin, which laid bare the depravity of the crime committed against him for all time. Mann further explored the violent histories that lay beneath the alluring beauty of the southern landscape in a series of photographs of Civil War battlefields made between 2000 and 2003. She realized at the time that with nearly a third of the battles of the Civil War fought in Virginia, the Commonwealth played an outsized role in the conflict. As she reflected upon the impact of this history on her native land, she asked, "Does the earth remember? Do these fields upon which unspeakable carnage occurred, where unknowable number of bodies are buried, bear witness in some way? And if they do, with what voice do they speak? Is there a numinous presence of death in these now placid battlefields, these places of stilled time?" She sought to answer this question in a series of photographs of the scrubby orphan corners of battlefields at Antietam, Cold Harbor, Fredericksburg, Manassas, and the Wilderness, all within easy striking distance of Lexington. Drawing inspiration from her photographs made in the Deep South, she believed, as authors such as Shelby Foote knew when he wrote his novel Shiloh, that the only way to connect the latent energy that lingers in a site charged with historical suffering was through an act of imagination and fiction. Although she made her photographs during the day, often under the hot sun and surrounded by gnats and busloads of tourists, her pictures bear no evidence of the present or even the ordinary. Instead, their dark, ominous tones suggest that they were taken in the twilight hours or during conflagrations so horrendous that the light of the sun was all but obliterated. Mimicking the view of a dying soldier, she positioned her camera close to the ground, tilted it to capture the high horizon line, and selectively focused on one spot in the composition, such as the picket fence there in Antietam Black Sun, or a stand of corn in Antietam Cornfield. Often, too, she punctuated these penumbral vistas with eerie, hard-to-define spots of light. These devices draw viewers into the composition, giving them points of reference around which to start to decipher the scene, but they also suggest the things a soldier might have seen before closing his eyes for the last time. She drew on the tropes first noted by Civil War photographers as well as the soldiers themselves as they sought to describe the shocking loss of life. At Antietam, where Robert E. Lee and George McClellan led opposing forces into battle in the single bloodiest day in the nation's history, she depicted the cornfields. There, Union officer Joseph Hooker remembered, "Every stalk of corn in the northern and greater part of the field was cut as closely as they could have been done with a knife, and the slain laid in rows precisely as they stood in their ranks a few moments before." And at the Battle of the Wilderness, where the densely wooded, nearly impenetrable terrain prompted hand-to-hand combat, and the artillery fire felled men and trees alike, she, like an unknown photographer in 1864, focused on a blasted young tree severed long before its prime. She also fully exploited the potential of her technique to impart meaning into her work. Like many Civil War photographers themselves, she began to use the 19th century wet collodion process to create her negatives. It required the photographer to coat a plate with a syrupy substance, which is what Sally is doing here, then dip it into a solution of silver salts, which combine with the collodion to make it light sensitive. The plate must then be loaded into a holder and then into the camera, exposed and developed all before the collodion has a chance to dry. But unlike her predecessors who sought to create pristine negatives, Mann readily embraced the flaws in hers, the scratches, pits, and peeling emulsion caused by her handling of the collodion, as they added metaphorical resonance to her pictures. Striving to conjure the immensity of the bloody, tragic conflict, whose fraught legacy continues to shape American identity and culture, she cultivated what she called the angel of uncertainty, praying with each exposure as she said, "Please don't let me screw it up, but if I do screw it up enough to make it interesting." Digging deeply into the expressive potential of her technique, she sought not what was seen, but what was invisible and felt, those intangible and ineffable traces of emotion and experience that linger in the land. She used riptides of collodion in several to suggest not only the inferno tearing through the sky at Fredericksburg, rending heaven and earth, but also the pain forever exuding from these tormented places. In some, bullets seem to fly, while in others, shrapnel rains down as if the conflict still raged. In yet more, smoke seems to rise from the ground as if the earth were ceaselessly smoldering in the battle's aftermath. The distressed nature of the plates themselves, with their torn, cracked, and peeling emulsion, and the irregular focus of the pictures, with their hazy, obscure passages, serve to intensify the sense of violence that occurred at these sites. Only a few, such as trenches, are relatively untouched by physical distress. Yet with its unnatural forms, ethereal light, and solitary cenotaphic tree marking the sacred ground, it too is infused with a pervasive sense of loss and death. In all of these pictures, as she pushed her technique to the limits of legibility, her compositions became more abstract, painterly, and darker than they ever had before, lodging deep in our memory like half-forgotten dreams whose meaning and resonance must be extracted. But they also shed the characteristics usually associated with photographs, becoming less literal, descriptive, and didactic, less connected to reality as it is usually seen, and less rooted in a specific time and place. As they grow more elusive, and both elusive and allusive, more open to imaginative interpretation, they become richly expressive of human experience and emotion. Further removing them from traditional expectations of glossy black and white photographs, she added texture and grit by coating them with a varnish that's made with diatomaceous earth. Those of you who are gardeners will know it's used in gardening, and it's the tiny fossilized or the remains of the fossilized remains of tiny aquatic organisms called diatoms. Thus, these works mimic the cyclical nature of life itself, echo the funeral service of the Book of Common Prayer, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and are composed of the very soil they depict. All of these elements combine to create photographs with an otherworldly presence. She intensified this spectral sense in her 2003 book, What Remains, by pairing some of her pictures of Antietam with lines from Walt Whitman's poem, Pensive on Her Dead Gazing, I Heard the Mother of All, an elegy written at the end of the war, where he implored, "Absorb them well, O my earth," she cried. "I charge you, lose not my sons, lose not an atom." The fourth section of our exhibition, titled Abide With Me, presents man's newest and most ambitious subject to date, a deeply personal reflection on the legacy of slavery and racism in the American South. Although she had begun to address these issues in the early 2000s, in the 1990s, during her trips to the Deep South, in the early 2000s, when she began the research and writing that would lead to the publication of Hold Still, she embarked on a period of intense self-examination. She began to consider how race, history, and the social structure of Virginia had shaped not only the landscape, but also her own childhood and adolescence. Striving to reach across what she called the seemingly untraversable divide between the races, she wanted to address the rivers of blood African Americans had poured into this land, as well as the courage they had displayed and the journeys they had taken as they sought to escape slavery. She did this by creating four groups of pictures. Two address physical and spiritual pathways, the rivers and swamps that had offered enslaved people potential escape routes to freedom, but where they just as often found death, felled by panthers, venomous snakes, and slave catchers, and the churches that promised a path to spiritual deliverance. And two other groups of pictures in the Abide With Me section depict African Americans themselves, men who modeled for man, and the one African American whom she knew best, Virginia Gigi Carter, who worked for man's family for more than 50 years and was a defining presence in her life. In 2008, as she began to look at the landscape as a story of oppression and the struggle for freedom, she photographed in the Great Dismal Swamp and along the nearby Blackwater and Nottoway Rivers in Southampton County. Long fascinated with Nat Turner, she knew that he had lived near these rivers when he led a slave rebellion in 1831 with brutal consequences. More than 50 white Virginians were killed and 56 African Americans were executed, including Turner himself, who was hanged, flayed, and beheaded, while more than 100 other enslaved people died at the hands of vigilantes. And she knew that the Great Dismal Swamp was Turner's presumed destination if his rebellion to conquer Southampton County did not succeed. Making tintypes, essentially collodion positives on lacquered metal sheets, Mann created pictures of a dark, impenetrable world. In several, she used the mirroring of trees, vine, and brush to intertwine reality and reflection so that they are nearly impossible to distinguish. Other pictures appear fogged as if clouded by oppressive humidity, steam, or smoke, while even more have such tumultuous skies with spindly or shattered trees and desolate bogs. They look as if a holocaust had just ravaged the area. Fully merging her technique with its metaphorical possibilities, she added to this sense of horror and conflagration by overexposing her tintypes and allowing their highlights to solarize and turn an unnatural metallic gray. Some, such as this one, as well as this one, are edged with an eerie, wavering, incandescent blue light, probably caused by excessive collodion building up on the plates, that adds to their otherworldliness. It may also refer to the bluish-green sun that Turner saw during a solar eclipse a week before he began the uprising, and that he interpreted as God's validation of his mission to free enslaved people. In all of these pictures, the highly reflective nature of the tintypes themselves combines with their extreme contrasts of black and white to present a world so horrific that only the most desperate and brave would dare to enter. While the photographs seem to describe the apocalyptic end to the world, they also suggest, as Turner professed, that the day, that Judgment Day was at hand. At the same time, Mann began to photograph African American churches. After Turner's rebellion in 1831, Virginia passed a law requiring African American congregations to meet only in the presence of a white minister. Thus, after the Civil War, when this law was no longer in effect, numerous all-black churches, both large and small, were established throughout the South, where they became the font of African American life, providing not only spiritual nourishment, but also places for schools, entertainment, and social organizations, as well as support for businesses and for social and political action. When Mann began to make these photographs, she discovered a book that directed her to very small rural churches that were only a few miles from Lexington, which she'd never known about before. Some were still active, such as the Bahula Baptist Church in Stewart's Draft. Founded in 1890, its members have continued to update the building and spiritually reactivate it for more than 100 years. Others were established, this book tells us, because of the vision of a single person of spirit and energy. And a handful, like Marl Hill Baptist Church or Payne's Chapel, now have no living members. She photographed them all with her 8x10-inch camera and ortho film, not collodion negatives. Presented as glowing abstract forms, they're alive with the spirit that inspired their creation and the memories of those who worshiped there. Recalling the hush or brush arbors where slaves said worshiped in the antebellum South, she depicted some overgrown by bushes and trees at one with nature. Others vibrate with an inner energy, their paint windows sparkling, their paint glowing. Still more seem as if they're evanescing at the moment of being assumed into heaven. Printed on expired photographic paper and toned with tea, these works take on a variety of colors, from light orange and eggshell to cool silver, as individual as the structures themselves. These churches, modest and patently built by devoted hands, are hidden in plain sight and mark what Toni Morrison has called benches, those places by the side of the road where you or I can go to think about or not think about, to summon the presence of or recollect the absence of slaves. And all convey the ecstatic moment Mann experienced when she went to church with Virginia G.G. Carter. As she wrote, "When the congregation was in full throat, I felt as if a great wave had picked me up and was rolling me over. I went with it, tumbling like a pale piece of ocean glass, washing up outside the heavy doors at the end of the service. Blinking in the sudden sunshine of Main Street, I reached for Gigi's hand." Mann also realized at this time that race had not only marked the region physically and spiritually, but also shaped the most intimate bonds within her own family. In particular, she looked back more critically at her relationship with Carter, someone whom she loved unreservedly. But now, as an adult, she saw ever more clearly that while her parents and her brother Chris had worked hard in support of the civil rights movement, the family had benefited from a social and legal structure that perpetuated the subjugation of African Americans and allowed someone like Gigi to work 12-hour days, 6 days a week for minimal pay, while it simultaneously denied her her basic human rights. Wrestling with her own complicity for all, as she said, all that I had not seen, had not known, and had not asked, she insisted that her family did not take Gigi for granted. She wrote, "We knew even then that her love was the real stuff that held our family together." But nevertheless, she was haunted by the stunningly unexamined way they had conducted their lives, especially towards Gigi. She wrote, "It's the obliviousness, the unexamined assumption that so pains me now. What were any of us thinking? Why did we never ask the questions? That's the mystery of it, our blindness and our silence." Seeking to understand more fully this woman who had been such a defining presence in her life, Mann reached out to Gigi's children and grandchildren to learn their memories of their own childhood and the person whom Mann wrote was the best mother a child could want. Gigi, the granddaughter of a former slave, and the daughter of a woman who was most likely raped by a white man, had died in 1994 at the age of 100. As Mann often did when she does when she explores her feelings about a person, she recalled the physical presence of this powerful, proud, and composed woman, who was built with the ageless sculptural proportions, she said, of the working woman. She wrote, "Diego Rivera would paint her, not Lucian Freud." Endowed with broad shoulders and cheekbones, Gigi's hands, she remembered, were bigger than my father's, with thick, heavily ridged nails glowing like pale beacons at the fingertips. Vivid memories of Gigi's inability to find shoes to fit her size 13 feet, or the fact that she wore Mann's mother's own old stockings, as Mann wrote, whose gossamer runs enlarged into ladder rungs as the day went on, their seams wobbling crazily. And also her father's discarded shoes, as she said, razor sliced to accommodate the corns on her toes, All of this took on new meaning and poignancy as Mann herself, now in her 60s, was more fully aware of the toll life takes on the body and spirit. She also looked back to the photographs she had taken in Gigi in the late 1980s and early 1990s, especially those of her with Mann's daughter, Virginia, who was named after Virginia Gigi Carter. Whereas once their entwined arms and feet had seemed like the emblems of the mingling of black and white, old and young, now they took on new connotations of Gigi's pain and persistence, her trials and endurance. And the photographs she had taken of Gigi boldly riding in the front seat of the car, not in the back seat as had previously been the unwritten rule in the South for African Americans, her long-fingered hand reaching across the divide, now seemed to speak to Gigi's willingness, albeit tentative, to embrace an uncertain future. But Mann also looked to the lessons Gigi taught her about her own conduct within the harsh reality of race relations in the South in the 1950s and 60s, and now saw them too in a new light. She recalls and holds still one instance in particular when, as a newly minted driver, she nonchalantly picked up a disabled young black man outside of Lexington and gave him a ride into town. When she got home, she casually announced to Gigi what she had done. She wrote, "I went on, and Gigi was listening, but then she was turning her body towards me with an ominous heaviness, as if a Henry Moore sculpture were being rotated 180 degrees. She had biscuit dough on her hands, but above those hands was that wide face, shiny with sweat, and was it anger? Anger at me? No, perhaps it was fear, but there was also anger, and it was taking over her features in a way I had never seen before. With her hands in the air, the way a surgeon holds them to push the paddle faucets when he is prepped for action, she pressed me back against the wall with her flowery forearms and said in a voice I'd never heard, low and afraid, 'Don't you ever pick up a colored boy again, no matter what, no matter who. You hear me?'" Although initially, as Mann admitted in her memoir, she was so self-centered, as she said, that I thought her concern was mostly for me, years later she recognized that it was unclear just which of us Gigi was most worried about. Mann also explored another unspoken but trenchant racial divide that marked her youth and shaped her interactions. African-American men, whom she never really saw, as she wrote, never really knew. She made her first attempts to photograph African-American men in 2006, hiring law students, kitchen workers, or laborers to model for her. But the project gained steam in 2009 when she encountered the dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones's production of Fondly Do We Hope, Fervently Do We Pray, a groundbreaking work that reflected on the legacy of Abraham Lincoln. Mann in particular was struck by how Jones celebrated the power and beauty of the African-American male body, even as he lamented and condemned the histories of racism and slavery that have subjected it to so much stereotype and projection. Inspired by this idea, Mann sought to make pictures that simultaneously acknowledge this division and invite connection, opening a doorway, as she wrote, that leads from an immutable past to a future that neither Gigi nor I would ever have imagined. As she tried to reconcile her love for the South with its brutal history, she endeavored to create photographs that attend to the nuances of individual men, but are also aesthetically resonant in some universal way. "When I work with these men," she noted, "my goal was to establish such a level of trust as to suspend, if only for a short time, our racial past. But I also hoped to convince the total stranger before me that these pictures we were making would be worth the risk in making himself so vulnerable." reflecting on the histories of oppression and struggle that continue to impact the experience of many African Americans and people of color. She wrote, to catch the ghosts and see the traces of all those who lived and died. Both beautiful yet challenging, these photographs seem to slip in and out of time, using 19th century processes to raise contemporary issues, and they are deliberately ambiguous. Is this, as Bill T. Jones himself asked, a photograph of someone about to be consumed by flames, or a phoenix rising from the ashes, even a black Christ, a liberator, and an emblem for African American freedom? Man titled the series as a whole, Abide With Me, weaving the pictures together like a long elegiac poem with passages of deep lament, sorrow, and solace. She infused them with a sense of penitence, empathy, and faith, with a recognition of a long, complicated history and the need to construct a better future. The title draws on the various uses of the word abide. She observed that while it means to accept and remain steadfast, abide is frequently used in the negative, as in, I cannot abide, to suggest the inability to tolerate. Abide With Me also draws on the Christian hymn of the same title, a prayer to God to remain steadfast through life's trials as well as in death. Begun at the dawn of Barack Obama's presidency, when the possibility of racial reckoning and reconciliation seemed more than a distant dream, and completed in the wake of the killings and racial unrest in Ferguson, Baltimore, Dallas, Charleston, Charlottesville, and too many other cities and towns across the country. The series Abide With Me is not only an elegy to 400 years of cruelty and intolerance, but also a hopeful and very personal cry from one artist for greater understanding and compassion for a better future. Our exhibition closes by returning to Man and her family, presenting a series of photographs that reflect on mortality, aging, and life's fragility. In 2004, Mann made a series of haunting close-up studies of her now-grown children and printed them in a startling, larger-than-life size of 40 by 50 inches. At once fugitive and vivid, profoundly affecting and dreamlike, Mann evoked qualities of fragility and transcendence by overexposing the plates and allowing the artifacts of the collodion process, the streaks and blurs, to function as visual metaphors for change and transformation. Following a severe riding accident in 2006, she made a series of self-portraits. Unable to lift her heavy, large camera, she set it up in one position and photographed herself at close range. Using a long exposure that registered slight movement as blur, she created a series of haunting self-portraits that range in emotion from meditative to almost demonic. Made as ambrotypes, that is, collodion positives directly on black glass, these pictures with their blurred, scarred, and scratched surfaces powerfully convey the experience of damage, while the variability among the plates suggests the mutability of self. The show ends with pictures of Mann's husband, Larry, from a series she titled Proud Flesh, a term used for the scar tissue that forms over a horse's wounds. Although Mann had photographed him regularly since they met in 1969, in the early 2000s she trained her camera on him, recording the effects of muscular dystrophy on his body. The 20th century is rich with male photographers who have photographed their significant others, from Alfred Stieglitz and Edward Weston to Harry Callahan and Emmett Gowan, to name but a few, but few female photographers before Mann have done so. Painfully honest yet tender, the pictures are ultimately a testament to the strength of their love and Larry's unwavering support of her art. Mann's titles speak of that love and a profound sense of loss. Although she mainly uses descriptive titles such as Antietam, Black Battlefields, Antietam, Black Sun, those she uses for her pictures of Larry are often drawn from literary and artistic sources, ranging from Greek mythology, classical art, and the Bible, to her favorite authors, including T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and Eudora Welty. In this work, for example, Mann connected Larry, who is both a lawyer and a blacksmith, with Hephaestus, the Greek god of metalworking, who was expelled from Mount Olympus, the home of the gods, because of a physical deformity. While the cracking and abrasions on Larry's muscled torso convey the ravages of the disease, the silvery, molten quality of the swirls alludes to the art of metalworking. Once again, using the flaws in her camera and technique to infuse meaning into her works, Mann referenced Vladimir Nabokov's autobiography, Speak Memory, in this work, which addresses memory's changeability over time and life's fleeting nature. The cradle rocks above an abyss, Nabokov wrote, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness. Yet while all of these pictures of her children, her husband, and herself reflect on the body's vulnerability to the ravages of time and the inevitable divide between spirit and matter, together they show her belief that only by looking death in the face can we fully savor life. Loss, she has written, is designed to be the catalyst for the more intense appreciation of life. We end our exhibition with three videos. The first, Sally Mann, Collodion and the Angel of Uncertainty, explores her use of 19th century photographic processes. Two other videos look more deeply at the Abide With Me section of the exhibition. One is of Mann and Bill T. Jones, who responds to her pictures of African-American men. And the other video is of one of Mann's models who describes the experience of sitting for her and his understanding of her project. The events of the last few years, the death of unarmed black men by law enforcement, the desecration of black churches, and the rise of white supremacist movements cast new light on Mann's work and demand that we continue to examine the legacies of slavery and racism. As a way to connect Mann's work to these larger questions, we have also organized a two-day public symposium titled History, Photography, and Race in the South from the Civil War to Now, which will be on April 13th and 14th, where scholars from around the country will discuss the intersection of photography, race, and representations of African Americans, and the responsibilities inherent in presenting racially and politically charged art. In addition, Frantz Scully Osterman, who taught Mann how to make collodion negatives, will speak on April 21st, and Clarissa Sly and Janine Mika Bales will speak on the evidence of things seen and unseen on May 20th. On August 12th, 2017, as we were finalizing the selection of objects for this exhibition, violence erupted at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, a little over 60 miles from Mann's home in Lexington. More than 150 years after the end of the Civil War, a protest sparked in part by the city's decision to remove a statue of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee from a public park ended in one death and many injuries. We hope that as we look for clarity in this moment of deep uncertainty and divisiveness, we may find in Mann's art part hope, part lament, one way to cross the chasm. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.